By now, you'll have heard or seen that I'm working with a new golf app called Tangent, who are also sponsoring this show. It's the smartest AI caddy in golf and is able to recommend not only clubs to hit, but target locations based on the math behind strokes gained and your own personal shot patterns. Unlike many other shot trackers, it also takes into account and adjusts for hazards that are out there. It has sensorless tracking with an amazing automatic swing detection that you can use with your Apple Watch or your phone without any need to buy any attachments for your clubs. And my favorite part, the post-round analysis data helps you immediately see where you can improve and gives you simple breakdowns that you can dive into if you want much more detail about your stats. It then links this data to recommendations and actual practice drills that you can use to improve. Getting measurable data for both on-course and practice drills makes Tangent one of the best game improvement ecosystems that I've ever seen. So download Tangent for free on the Apple App Store or at tangent.golf and use promo code SWEET30, that's SWEET30, for 30% off. So you'll get a free trial, and if you like it and want to continue, it'll give you 30% off a subscription. So just try it out, play a few rounds with it, and I know you'll love it. So that's Tangent, T-A-N-G-E-N-T, and enter code SWEET30. John and I have just got an amazing set of clothing from Roback, our show sponsor. We have polos that are perfect for golf, and they have the best collar in the game as they don't lose their shape, making you look crisp and sharp on the golf course. They've got a great stretch performance fabric that fits much better than boxy polos, and they even have some really fun designs. Or if you're like me, you'll go for more of the classic solids. The quarter zips are super soft and really easy to swing and move in, and their golf hoodies are perfect for on and off the course too. John and I are huge fans, so make sure to get yourself some amazing golf clothing and support our sponsors. Head to roback.com, spelled R-H-O-B-A-C-K.com, to get 20% off your first purchase through the end of the week using code SWEET. The link is in the show notes. So that's roback.com, spelled R-H-O-B-A-C-K.com.
Welcome back to another episode of The Sweet Spot. This is John Sherman from the Foundations of Golf. And as always, I'm joined by
Adam from Adamian Golf.
So we get a ton of questions from people all the time. We're very appreciative. We get feedback as well. We appreciate that, except the people who are nasty to me. Don't give me feedback. No, I'm kidding. That's okay. So we're going to do another. We love doing Q&A episodes here and there. So we had a This is kind of a continuation of our last one because we got so many questions, I think, on Twitter, and I've got a few here from my emails. So we're going to do another listener mailbag here, Adam, right?
Yeah, I'm good with that. I am good with that. I got all the questions written down, and I'm sure we can make 2 hours out of this.
All right. Anything new to report on your end? Anything exciting in your golf game?
I'm still on my first coffee, so my last week is not in the forefront of my mind right now, but okay. I know congratulations to you for dominating the top books list.
Oh,
was it that thing I posted on Twitter? Was like 4 of the 5 top books were yours?
Yes, I don't know when this episode will be released. As usual, we're in like a time warp here. Today's April 1st when we're recording this, but this might not come out till like heck May. But yeah, The Foundations of Winning Golf, my new book, had a very nice release. Got to on the top of the bestseller list, and appreciate. Would not be possible without all the listeners and people who support us. So thank you for that. And thank you,
Adam. He says on his yacht.
Yeah. I'm no longer doing the sweet spot with my book royalties. They're just like floating around everywhere in this yacht I'm on. No, but seriously, appreciate everyone's support. Appreciate your support, Adam. I just hope people appreciate the book and find value from it.
I played with a sweet spot listener this Saturday, and on the topic of the book, you know, he was like, oh, it's nice to play with a sweet spot. It's weird to be around you. And you know, it's that idea that, well, we're just normal people, right?
Yeah.
I joke and say you're on your yacht, but we're just normal people. You've got your family. We're just trying to make a living. So we do genuinely appreciate any of the support that people, when people buy our books, buy our products. We're just out here trying to make a living by helping you guys out. So yeah, we appreciate it a lot.
Like I say to everyone on Twitter when they say something like that, I'm like, I'm just a guy who tweets and writes and talks from his basement. So for those of you who met me in person, you know it's nothing that impressive.
Yeah, we're really both unimpressive people. Although, did you see my Instagram post the other day? I did something a little crazy. I hit, how far do you think the drive was? I'll give you two guesses.
Are we talking foresight distance or real distance?
This is real distance.
Okay.
I will preface it by saying downhill, downwind.
In Vegas?
Yeah.
In Vegas. Okay, I'm going to say 370 yards.
More.
410.
Oh, more. 424.
420, wow.
Yeah,
holy cow.
A genuine drive. Yeah, it's a ridiculous hole. It was straight downhill and it was downhill.
Was it off the Grand Canyon?
Pretty much, yeah. Honestly, it's a very downhill hole. But so I played with the sweet spot listener, and I won't mention his name just in case he doesn't want to. But it was one of the windiest days I've ever had. So my longest drive was 424, and my shortest drive that was into the teeth was 210. That shows you the difference in, yeah, that's how strong the wind was.
Talk about dispersion.
Yeah, exactly. So hopefully every time we go out at the moment, it's super windy. So I'm just waiting for this weather to clear up. But it's fun doing that occasionally. But my strokes gained are horrible right now because
wind is
playing in the gale.
Yeah, it's hard to score well when you're past, I'm assuming you're past 20 miles an hour.
Well, it doesn't help you even downwind. Like, you'd hit shots and you'd be 60, 70, 80 yards away from the green. And you're like, there's no way of holding this. It was that strong.
Wow.
Hard green. So it's like, it just throws your strokes gained out. So that's a little point in there as well. All right, John, what questions do we have to start with?
I'll start with one I got via email. I think I got this over a month ago, but I kind of kept it in the back of my head. Someone emailed me asking, you know, they were getting lessons and were wondering about like distance with irons. So the question was, is like, I have this kind of one swing where I can hit my 7-iron very far, like 175, 180, but it's the dispersion's kind of all over the place. Or I can hit like the 160, 165 yard 7-iron with a much tighter dispersion. And his question was, is like, well, is distance important with irons like it is with driver? So, you know, I think that's an important distinction to make because we do talk about that a lot on the show where, yeah, you want to advance the ball as far as possible off the tee. But I think some people sometimes get a little distance craze with their irons. And irons, you know, your approach plays a different question. It's how far can you hit it? In terms of distance control, not like how far can you hit it? Like, can you hit the 7-iron like 210? So it's not always good to pursue more distance with irons if your dispersion's struggling. So I told him, I said, the answer is always, whether it's this question on, should I go with the faster swing or draw or fade? Whatever gives you the tightest dispersion with these shots, you want to know where the ball's going. And if you hit your 7-iron 160, 165, like that's fine. As long as you know it's going that distance and it's a better dispersion. Whereas, you know, if you wanted to like step on it and hit it farther just for the sake of hitting it farther, but you lose your control, then that's not good. I mean, the best iron player I know that I've played with does not hit his irons very far. Like, I'm a full club longer than him, but he just controls his distance trajectory like nothing I've ever seen. And he shoots scores that I think many of you would be happy with. And I think he hits his 7-iron like 165, 170, and he could still drive at 300. So yeah, we're chasing distance control and tighter dispersion with irons, not distance.
I think the mistake people make with that is they trying to compare 7-iron versus 7-iron. That's not how you should do it. What you should do is hit to a target, let's just say 160, 170, and then hit your hard 7 or your soft 6 and see which one has the tightest dispersion. Say you did have a swing that was 2 clubs longer, but it was a little bit more dispersion. Well, if you're hitting to 150, that might be the difference between hitting an 8-iron there and a wedge there. And yes, your wedge may have more dispersion, your long versus your short wedge may have more dispersion with the long one. However, your long wedge might still be tighter than your short 8-iron. So test it to a given yardage. I mean, from a physics point of view, yes, the shorter club, the higher loft is going to be straighter, all else being equal. If you had the same face variance, the higher lofted club is going to be more straight or have a tighter dispersion. But that's not taking into account the human element of it. When we swing a club super hard, we might create much more face variance. And so that throws the physics part out of it. So the only way to do it is just, like I said, test. Pick a yardage, test a hard versus a soft, or fade versus draw. Pick the one that's a tighter dispersion.
It actually reminds me, I think this was like 2 or 3 years ago, and hopefully I don't mangle the results, but Lou Stagner had asked a ton of people on Twitter with launch monitors to do this test, saying, all right, hit 5 shots, your stock 7-iron or whatever it was, 5 shots going hard at it and 5 softer. And he had them like repeat a certain amount of times so that the data wasn't fuzzy. And I did it as well. And I was actually one of the outliers where I think I went after it. I was more accurate when I went after it harder, but he said most people overwhelmingly were more accurate when they didn't go after. Like, so that softer 7-iron was better than the harder 7-iron in terms of like.
Was that to the same target though?
Yeah.
Or
yes,
same
yeah.
club?
Same club, but it was just like, should you tone down your swing to control yardage or go after it harder to hit it farther? Toning it down was better for most people. But again, yeah, just test it if you have access to this stuff.
Yeah, I've done that test a lot with players. And I also do fades versus draws versus straight. And again, so even in my own game, if I'm hitting to a certain target, a fade 7-iron might be versus a draw 8-iron. So the draw goes longer for me. And then I just test which one's the tightest dispersion and play with that for that week.
Cool. All right. I think we answered that one. Now it's your turn.
Help for a senior golfer who has lost distance. I mean, this applies to anybody really, but I know it's, I haven't quite reached that point where I'm going backwards with distance. Yeah, you haven't either, John. It's inevitable. It's the decay of the human body. We're all, what is it, death, taxes, and losing distance in our golf game. All certainties. So with distance, I mean, we've got 3 dials that we can improve, right? We can improve ball speed, or we can, if we hit a combination of higher launch and lower spin, then that can increase distance as well. Most people never get to the optimal numbers, which is a launch of about 18 degrees and a spin of about 2,000. There, that's about optimal for almost all speeds. Gets a little different when you get to super high ball speeds, but those are the 3 dials that we can improve or change. So hitting up on it is probably one of the lowest hanging fruits. Hitting more up, getting the club to work on a more ascending angle through impact, that will improve the launch. It doesn't automatically improve the spin component of it, but it gives you opportunity to reduce the spin. And there are lots of things you can do to reduce the spin. So once you're hitting up on it, that ball's going to be launching higher because all else being equal, you get a golfer, a robot to hit up on it more. You're applying more loft as well, tends to be. So you get the ball launching higher. Then you can reduce the spin by changing ball, changing strike location, or you could reduce dynamic loft as well. So you bring in the spin loft down and that will actually increase ball speed as well. So does that make sense? Any questions on that, John?
No, I mean, we've covered this quite a bit. We have a 2-part episode on driver distance. We've had multiple experts on swing speed, TPI, Mike Carroll. We just had Alex Ehlert. Hopefully I didn't pronounce his last name improperly. I think that episode should be out now. So yeah, I mean, you have 2 to 3 options in terms of strike efficiency, which you just discussed, hitting it more centered on the face, launching it higher, less spin. Swing speed element, which could be, depends if people want to do the weightlifting, the speed training, all that other stuff. I still think that's a good idea, even for seniors. I always see Mike Carroll posting videos of golfers in their 60s, 70s, and 80s getting after it in the weight room, and they're kind of reversing the trend of aging. So it is possible, but yeah, all that stuff's at your disposal. But we've covered it so much in different episodes that you definitely can go back. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, if you go to our driving episode, right?
Yeah, we got it all there. So definitely go back to that one. So not much else to add there.
One thing you can do, a couple of things you can do for speed that goes a little beyond speed training or weight training is just to increase the range of motion. There's a couple of things that you can do that don't require hitting the gym. So more hip turn. And if you're inflexible, that could just be foot flare. You know, if you in your backswing, for example, if you really struggle to make a big turn in the backswing and you've got your foot, your right foot square and pointing at the ball almost, just flare it out 10, 20, 30 degrees. And that's going to unlock 10, 20, 30 degrees more body rotation, which can lead to a longer hand path, which can lead to more club speed. You can also pick up the lead foot, just like Jack Nicklaus did. It went away. I think probably Hogan was one of those who tried to keep his foot down or talked about that kind of stuff. Maybe in Ledbetter's era as well, that coaching, everything was about restriction and keeping your foot on the ground. And we kind of lost those heel lifts. But if you go back to the swings of the 50s, 60s, 30s, Sneed, Nicklaus, I mean, Nicklaus wasn't 50s, what am I talking about? But yeah, Bubba Watson would be a great modern example of that. You know, wasn't taught to restrict things. And as a result, his swing looked very Nicklaus-like. Pick that lead foot up. Just testing these things out. I know my swing speed can jump another couple, two, three, sometimes even 4 mile an hour by allowing that left foot to raise up and then stamp it down on the downswing to start the downswing. Increases range of motion, increases ground forces, whatever it is, it can increase swing speed. And then you have to test that, just like the 7-iron, right? Test it, do 100 swings lifting your heel up, 100 swings keeping it on the ground. See, did it improve distance? What did it do to accuracy? And then you can run some strokes gain simulations if you want to see if they actually gain you strokes.
Indeed. I have nothing to add.
Cool. All right.
On to the next one. All right, here's the one I always like to tackle, although many books have been written about it. So negative thoughts are incredibly destructive, particularly when playing. Those thoughts are not going away. Therefore, along with breathing methods, what do you say to yourself to manage thoughts to a positive result in a very tight time window? So yeah, I think we always talk about this inevitably in the mental game when we cover it with, you know, different experts and different episodes. If I'm answering it quickly, I think one thing to consider with negative thoughts is that they're not going away. So like that's step number one. The thought of playing golf without negative thoughts is crazy to me. So if your expectation is that when they're happening, like, well, I can't play well now or hit a good shot, then you're already like fighting against yourself. So I and many other people think that the best you can do is kind of be at peace with that and understand that you having some type of doubt or anxiety or something occur during the round is entirely normal. One method that I like, and there's many, but I'll just mention it quickly, and I put this in my new book, was the thought of redirection. So there was a quote from Novak Djokovic. I might have mentioned it on the show before when they asked him, like, what makes you better now than you used to be with the mental game? Because many consider him like the top tennis player of all time now, and they would say like this guy's mental game is incredible. And I think tennis offers a similar challenge to golf that way because it's more of like a solitary game. And he was like, well, initially I just tried to be present all the time. I thought that bad thoughts were, having a negative thought was bad and I had to be perfectly present all the time. And what I realized is like that was just fighting a losing battle. And when I got more mature, being able to accept that and then redirect my mind was way more beneficial and realistic. So it wasn't saying to yourself, oh, you can't stand on the tee box thinking that like I might put this out of bounds or, oh crap, I just had three really bad holes. I suck. Like that's okay. That's fine. Now your ability to redirect it somewhere else is more important. So I think that alone is super important. And then, so how do you redirect? Well, yeah, there's many things at your disposal. I think the breathing is really good. Routines, like you have to find something else to occupy your mind. I've spoken about playing songs in my head, breathing, thinking about my children, just kind of dulling my thoughts into the distance and like looking at the trees and kind of like saying, like, wow, this is awesome to be here. So you do have to find creative ways to redirect your mind. I think that's one of the things you have to like hang your hat on. And I think that's kind of how our brains work. Like we don't multitask. You can't think of like three things at once. So if you have like that negative thought, you're like, what else can I think of to kind of replace this in the moment? And routine is a really good one. So I think that's the name of the game, is that you're not necessarily going out on the golf course with the goal of not having negative thoughts. Like there's way to reduce them in terms of like your overall belief system, but that's kind of deeper work you need to do. But it's more of when they do happen, what other ways can I replace them? Not always, but more often. So that's kind of how I think about this in a short explanation.
Yeah, it's interesting that the most negative thoughts I have are usually with my driver. Like I'll often stand over a driver thinking, I have no idea where this is going to go. This could go anywhere.
Yeah,
the driver is the best club in my bag.
Yeah.
But it's the best club in my bag. So I don't, there's a big talk that, oh, if your technique is good, then you're not going to have negative thoughts. So those are the technique people who are anti-psychology. And I'm like, well, no, because my driver is the best club in my bag. And that's the worst mindset that I have. But like you said, negative thoughts are going to happen. I play some of my best golf with a lot of horrible stuff going on in my head. In fact, the albatross that I had last year, the top of my backswing, I thought, don't fat this. You're going to fat this. Oh my God, this is going to be a huge chunk shot. I don't know why. I just took a backswing and it felt like one of those that was going to dump it into the ground, but I didn't. Yeah, so negative thoughts, they're always going to happen. You can't really stop them happening a lot of the time. But what you can do is, like you said, redirect, focus on what you do want. So ask yourself questions. You know, if it's happening in the routine, ask yourself questions. Where do I want to land this? Make the questions more specific. What type of shape do I want to see here? What club am I going to use? What's the wind doing? So, you know, this is where having a caddy helps a lot for the top pros, is they can ask them lots of questions, keep their mind on the task. But yeah, it's one of those things. Have you seen that? There's a YouTube clip where if you type in, oh God, attention and then gorilla experiment, it basically at the start of the video, it's a 1 minute video and it asks you, how many passes do the white team make? So there's two basketball teams, there's two basketballs, and they're all just in a massive mess running around on the screen. And you've got to watch the white team and see how many times they pass it. And at the end of it, they say, so how many times do they pass it? And you confidently go 13, and it comes up on the screen 13, and you think, yes, I'm awesome at this. And then it says, but did you see the gorilla? And you're like, what? And then they rewind the video, and in the middle of it, a guy in a gorilla suit comes in, does a little break dance, and you do not see him. So what's the moral of the story there is, if you are so focused on one thing, it actually, it takes away attention from other things. Just like if you're reading a good book, you don't hear the drilling that's going on outside. It doesn't bother you because you're so immersed in the book. So yeah, by asking yourself questions, by trying to get immersed in what you do want, you're much more likely to lose those negative thoughts. But understand, we're human. We can't always control them.
Yeah, it's really like kind of a big game of distraction is what
yeah.
The mental game in golf is. Like, how can I distract my mind? Because the easiest thing to do is get to the negative stuff, because it's the game that makes you think negatively a lot. And the last thing I'll leave with is, I alluded to this earlier, is more of like your belief system. So I think, you know, there is a way to be less negative on the course. Like, I think everyone kind of has like a baseline negativity that they step onto the course with. And I think it requires like some deeper work and introspection to change that baseline level. So if you're someone who is just really hard on yourself and not accepting of outcomes in general, or doesn't have the right mindset on what are good outcomes, and like you step on the course with that kind of negative dial already, I'm speaking confusingly, dialed higher, then yeah, you're going to struggle more. I don't think it's a good thing to play with a lot of negative thoughts. So there is some work you can do off the course with like your belief system on how to be less negative overall, which I absolutely think can help you. Like if I took, well, I'll use your 100 golfer example. If you took 100 golfers and you had their negative mindset on the course and were able to measure that, like, yeah, I think that'd be a good predictor of scoring. I would say overall, the golfer that's way more negative and have more negative thoughts would struggle to play well. Like it's kind of making the game harder for yourself. But that's not to say that, again, you can't have the negative thoughts and get through them. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword. Fascinating topic to me. I always love talking about this.
I mean, there's two ends of the spectrum. There's the there's the expectations thing. So we all see that person who hits it to 12 feet from 100 yards and gets upset with it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That shouldn't be how, 20 feet and gets upset with it. And that shouldn't be happening. And I'm guilty of being that player, definitely. Some things that have helped me with that, you know, especially with fairways, understanding fairways in regulation has helped me with a lot of acceptance. Understanding what Scott Fawcett talks about and Lou Stagner with the 60-yard dispersion circle, whoever came up with that, whoever got the data for that, that makes a lot of sense and really helps me. You know, there'd be a time where I would hit it 30 yards offline with a driver and be like, oh my God, this is, I need to overhaul my swing. But now I do it and I'm like, within tour dispersion, believe it or not. And then the other side is looking at launch monitors from my coaching perspective, understanding that when I flare one out 30 yards right, I've left the face open 2 degrees. That's all it is. It's negligible. And we're human. Just accept these things. It sucks. Yeah, we don't want to do it, but it's going to happen. The other side of that would be, I suppose, if you are having a lot of negative thoughts, you might be taking on shots that are beyond your ability as well. So, you know, if it's a super tight fairway and you shouldn't be hitting driver down there, you're going to be standing over there very negative. I mean, it's hard to get negative on a wide open field, isn't it, with no trees on it, when you can blast anyway. It's hard to have a negative mindset there because you know your ability matches the task demands. So yeah, I mean, that's a thing to look at as well, is are you taking on shots that are beyond your level of your capability? If you're trying to fly a 3-wood 230 over water onto a par 5 in 2 and you then chunk it and you go, oh, I was negative on that. It's like, yeah, but that shot, you have a 1 in 10 chance of hitting at your level. So it was more the shot selection. The other thing I'd say with this whole stuff is I get a lot of the negative thoughts with my driver and I notice them. The thing that I do, my tactic, is when it happens, I find myself getting tense. I just say to myself, you're getting tense. Just accept anything here. This is just make a free swing at it and accept any outcome. And that helps me not get too steery, because that's when I can get bad with the driver.
We are going to take a quick break and we will be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Maui Nui Venison, a mission-based food company bringing the healthiest red meat on the planet directly to your door. My wife and I have been absolutely obsessed with their products the last few months, cooking with their meat and eating their jerky. Also, Maui Nui has a very special operation going on, and it is the only stress-free, 100% wild-harvested red meat on the market. And most importantly, it's seriously delicious and easy to cook. My wife and I have cooked many of their recipes, including meatballs, different loins, and it is delicious. Perhaps my favorite products are their all-natural venison jerky sticks. You get 10 grams of protein and just 55 calories. This is a great snack after a workout, or you can bring it on the course if you're feeling a little hungry, and you'll get a huge kick of protein with very little calories. Perhaps one of the most important things for me is that there's only 1.5% fat in all of their meat. I know I'm getting maximum protein, nutrient-dense calories, and more importantly, it's very low in saturated fat. And that's something that's really important to me in my diet. Because there's such a limited supply of their meat, they open up a few monthly restocks available for purchase. So now for our offer. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com/golf and take advantage of this limited time offer for 20% off your first order. Once again, that's MauiNuiVenison.com/golf. MauiNuiVenison.com/golf. Or use the coupon code GOLF to get 20% off your first order. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. You can post your job for free at linkedin.com/sweetspot. LinkedIn is not just a job board. It helps you hire professionals you cannot find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job, but might be open to a new perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. Also on LinkedIn, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. hire professionals like a professional on LinkedIn. Just recently, they even launched a new feature that helps you write your job description, making the process even easier and quicker. And they know that small business owners like myself and Adam are wearing so many hats and might not have the resources to hire, so it's a great place to get help. Now, here's what you can do. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/sweetspot. That's linkedin.com/sweetspot to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Yeah, we're all just finding these little things for ourselves. But yeah, hopefully that'll give everyone some ideas on that. All right, your choice. Next question.
What stats to keep track of in a practice session? I think the main things that we talk about, left or right miss, obviously. If it's within certain boundaries, so set parameters for yourself of what's acceptable. You can use things like Google Earth, or I have a special system in the accuracy plan that I use that doesn't require Google Earth. But yeah, you can. I used to go to Vegas driving range here, and I'd have it all mapped out on Google Earth. I'd know between this green and this green was 20 yards, between this green and this green was 30 yards, so then I could hit shots and know that that's my dispersion. So tracking left or right misses, tracking ground contact errors, and tracking face contact errors. So after each shot, don't just ask yourself that, but have a little notepad. And this, I think this person who asked the question said, I've bought a little notepad, what should I put in it? Just a little table, top column, ground contact, face contact, left and right, and then just go through on the rows 1 to 10 and see which error is popping up more, and then place more of your focus there, place more of your changes. If you're making swing changes, try and make them relevant to that. If you find you're hitting lots of fat shots, then try and make a swing change that relates to that, not just an aesthetic swing change. If you want to dive super deep into these things, I get players to look at what are the averages. So if you hit 1 inch behind, and I get people to use the divot board for this as well, so they can really monitor, okay, that was 1 inch behind, that was 2 inches behind. And then at the end of 10 shots, you get an average. You can even look at standard deviations to see how consistent that average is, if you want to look at that. And you can see a bias as well. So I used negative numbers to indicate behind the ball and positive numbers to indicate in front of it, or negative numbers indicate left, and positive numbers indicate right. So say, for example, you hit one shot 10 yards right, and then the next shot is zero, then the average of that is 5 right. So you can see there's a bias there, and that might influence your strategy when you're on the golf course. I know I have a tendency to be about 3 to 5 yards left when I train. So that's why I always aim a little bit more to the right of my target on the golf course to allow for that bias. Anything you track in training, John?
I don't think I'd have anything. You're way better at this stuff than I am, but I think it depends. You know, this person who asked the question is obviously more analytical and willing to do this type of stuff. And I'm probably not like that as much. I'm more of like, I'm keeping track of this stuff by feel. I'm like, oh, the last few were kind of left, you know, low heel type shots. So I'm taking note of it, but I'm not like physically writing it down. I'm just not like that. I'm not as analytical and note-taking type person. So we always want you to be aware of these things when you're practicing. And definitely if you are going to keep track of it, I think everything you said makes more sense. And I wouldn't have anything to add to it. Just making sure that you're not, especially like when you're on the launch monitors, like the average numbers and stuff like that, sometimes they can be misleading because you hit 20 yards right, 20 yards left, the average is zero. So
that's where standard deviation comes in then.
Yeah, you got to go a little deeper than that. And if you're paying attention in the right way, I think you would note that in your brain. But no, I don't have, that's more your realm. So I'll defer to you on that stuff.
I'd agree with you. I think most people eventually should get to the stage where this is just done on an unconscious level, or just a generalized idea in your head of what the patterns are. I just find that the average golfer is very bad at this, and they can start out by at least doing a couple of sessions where you train actually taking notes. Doesn't mean you have to do it for every session. In fact, a good way of doing this is just do your first session, take notes, get maybe 20 samples. And then a month later, do it. Get 20 samples and see if you've improved. So that's a way of bridging the gap or being that middle ground, that sweet spot between the analytical and the non-analytical player.
No, that makes sense. Like, especially if someone was starting with impact location and was spraying the face. Let's say you were like, all right, I'm going to draw an image of the driver here. I'm going to mark an X everywhere I make impact on it after 10 or 20 shots. So you have like a visual diagram. And just by doing that, looking at it, you're like, wow, I seem to be healing a lot of them very high or, you know, low toe. And then something's going to happen in that process where you're like, okay, now I know what that feels like. I've taken some time to look at this stuff. That is how you create the feedback loop that we always talk about. So definitely for the more beginner to intermediate player, taking those moments to really slap yourself in the face with the feedback is pretty much what we're saying is beneficial.
And on tracking it, you know, the reason why I'm so obsessive compulsive with that stuff is because I've seen it so many times in lessons. I've done it with players where after each shot, we always get the feedback. Where was that on the face? What was the ground contact? Blah, blah, blah. But then at the end of, say, a 10, 20 ball trial, I will ask them, I'll say, so what were your patterns then? And they always, most of the time, they'll throw up their hands and go, I don't know, maybe it was a little heel. And I was like, every single one was some form of heel shot. It's very difficult for many people to keep track of this mentally, even if the feedback is there each shot. Curating that into a big pile is kind of hard for people. And I even find it difficult myself on the golf course. I might get to the 10th hole and go, you know, what have my patterns been today? And then I go through and I say, well, that was left. Oh yeah, that was left as well. Oh, and that was left. And I'll get there and I'll say, shit, 9 out of 10 of my shots were left today. Why didn't I pick up on that? What's wrong with me? And then I can make an adjustment from there. And obviously tracking and writing these things down prevent that from happening. As you see that data growing, you'll make the adjustment from there. What I'll do for this as well, I'll create a free PDF, something you can download, print out, just so it gives you an idea. I'll put a little ditty in there as well, maybe a one-page idea of how to use it, what type of things to track, as well as the actual tracking sheet. I'll do that, adamyounggolf.com/track, T-R-A-C-K. So if you are that way inclined, go and download it. Even if you're not, get some baselines and test it a month later.
Very nice. All right, shall we move on to the next one?
Yeah.
Is it my turn? This is a pretty straightforward one, but I think a good one. What is a bad shot, okay shot, and good shot? Which I think is an important distinction to make. Again, I'll preface this by saying this is certainly relative to skill level and experience, but I think it's important. The first section of my book, The Four Foundations of Golf, I really dealt with this in terms of expectation management, just showing people, well, what's a good iron shot for a 15 handicap, or what's a good drive? So I think on a generic level, if we were to split them up into different parts of the game, tee shot, approach shot, wedge play, putting, I'll start with a driver or any tee shot. So I think a good shot would be when you hit it close to your average distance or your distance potential, and it's in the fairway. Okay, that's a good shot. So let's say a good drive for you, an average drive is 240 yards. You hit it that distance, it's in the fairway. Like, yep, that's a good shot. Everyone knows that, obviously. I think an okay shot slash good shot would still be in the rough with a manageable lie with a clear path to the green. And then I'd move closer to the okay shot when you kind of have a tougher lie or in a fairway bunker. But the bad shots are when, yeah, I'd say you put yourself in a recovery situation. Let's say you do hit that driver 240 and you hit it 180. Like, let's say you just, you know, you kind of thinned it or topped it, obviously out of bounds, penalty areas, like when you inflict major damage on yourself. But the name of the game with driver and tee shot is keeping the ball in play with a clear path to the green and hopefully advance the ball farther. So yeah, I think it's living in that good shot to okay shot land where you just have opportunities to hit the green. If you miss the fairway, it's not the end of the world, and you could still get it up there close to the green or on it, and you have that opportunity. Like, that's okay. That would be my starting point with the definition with tee shots. Anything different or to add there?
No, I think it depends on level as well.
What you're playing.
where you are, but yeah, I mean, at the pro level, what is it, like 5% away from the target, if you're doing the math version, is pretty good. I think 10% away or more is a bad shot. So if you're 150 yards away, 7.5 yards from the target is a very good tour level shot. And 10% or 15 yards away at 150 is a bad shot. That's well outside of tour ranges. And then the average is what, somewhere in between that.
They're on a much tighter leash. Let's put it that way. It's really because of the competition they're under is just crazy. So with approach play, similar stuff. Like, I think a good shot, I'd say good, is when you're on the putting surface. So if you hit a green in regulation, I really don't care from what distance. I think that's a good shot for almost every skill level. An okay shot, you know, if you're drawing the line, let's say a mid 10, 15 handicapper, like an okay shot is around the green with a manageable wedge shot. So let's say you've avoided a bunker or being short-sided, or you're not in like the gnarly rough and you just kind of, you're on the fairway or it's a decent lie in the rough and you've got some green to work with, like that's okay. That's how you make a lot of boring bogeys and not doubles and triples, like hitting a lot of those okay shots where you don't shoot yourself in the foot. And yeah, bad shot with approach play, the chunks, the skulls, the big pulls and pushes where you're short-sided or you hit it into the water, like that's the bad stuff where you're just like, you really inflicted some damage and you kind of almost lost a full shot there with something. We know what they feel like, but again, living between that good to okay world, like good is on the putting surface, even if you have a 50 footer, like anytime you landed on the green in regulation, like that's a big check mark because you've given yourself a much better chance of making a routine par. And I know we want birdies and you'll get those opportunities too. The okay stuff is just kind of like a straightforward wedge shot around the green. Like that's how simple I try and make it. And then, yeah, as you get better, yes, for a scratch golfer from 150 yards in the fairway, they're going to be hitting a lot more greens than a 15 handicap. But still, even for them, like if they hit it 40 feet away from the hole and they've got a wedge in their hand or a putter, like that's fine. It's totally normal and good outcome.
Yeah, when I'm practicing on a launch monitor, if I'm hitting a 7-iron, I use about 10 yards either side as boundaries, 10 yards left, 10 yards right, anything within that I'm pretty happy with. That's going to have a good average. If it goes more than 15 yards off, that's when I'm upset, smashing clubs.
Breaking everything.
Monitor, yeah. With a driver, yeah, anything within 20 yards either side, it's not fun, but you know, I'd call a good shot anything 15 yards either side. Anything 20 yards either side, I don't really bat an eyelid. Once it goes 30 yards, that's when I'm like, oh god, that was pretty bad. But you know, it's still, these are what tall players do as well, so it's not the end of the world. They are, yep, about 50 yards longer than me though, but who cares about that
little detail. Yeah, but wedge play, it's, you know, if you look at the stats on wedge play and like proximity, most, or I shouldn't say most, almost all players are not averaging inside of 8 feet from just about anywhere. So yeah, I would define that as a good shot. Like if you had a wedge shot inside of 50 yards and you got it inside a 10-foot circle around the green, like that's good for pretty much any level. You feel good about those, but it's more like the okay shots are, I think, inside the 20-foot circle, where you gave yourself a par putt, but you've also tremendously reduced the chances of a three putt for double bogey. Then obviously that shifts down a stroke per par fives. So then you have your chance at a birdie putt or two putt par. Yeah, those are like the okay to good shots where you're between 10 to 20 feet from the hole, maybe a little bit further. Like those are all totally fine because we've talked about wedge play before, and I think the biggest challenge for most players is getting to a place where you can stand over the ball. I'm trying to get there again myself. And you're like, I know the shot I'm going to hit. I know this technique. I feel pretty good that this is going to go on the green and I'm not going to chunk it or scull it. And I can get it inside that like 20-foot circle. Like when you start feeling good about that, like you've become a pretty good wedge player. Getting inside the 10-foot circle, like more often, like that's much, much, much harder. That requires a much higher level of skill and more time, I think, for most players. So yeah, I think living between the okay to good is like that 10 to 20-foot circle around the hole. And then the bad shots are obviously like, yeah, you don't want to take two shots in the rough or scull it over the green or lay the sod over it. That's where a lot of players quickly lose strokes around the green or the bunkers as well, where they just don't have a reliable technique to get the ball on the putting surface. That's living in the okay to good world for wedge play is removing those more often. But it's not about hitting a bunch of, like, I remember standing over the ball thing, like the goal is 3 feet. I need that tap in par. That's just way too much pressure on yourself, I think. And you're also going to make some bad strategic decisions if you're in like tougher situations as well.
And obviously we can use strokes gained as well to determine what a good shot or a bad shot is compared to our level. You know, there are apps out there like Tangent does it on a shot by shot basis as well. So you can actually go in and see each shot and how many strokes gained you had on that individual shot, not just as an overall. So you can go through your round and see, oh, this was a good shot. Oh God, I lost a lot of strokes there. So yeah, done with that question. We can move on.
Putting, I want to say? I mean, putting, like, if you make a putt, it's good. But so putting's like, everyone's like, oh, good make, miss bad. And that's
no.
Go my book, Brody's book, a ton of online resources now show putting make percentages. But yeah, I mean, the name of the game in putting is like increasing your chances of making it inside of 10 feet. But most of it is outside of 10 feet. Leaving yourself like those comfy 2 to 3 footers. Like those are all good putts. And once you get outside of 10 feet, your chances of making it drop dramatically. I don't care how good you are. And a lot of it's just proximity and 3-putt avoidance. And then, yeah, if you want to become a better putter, you want to make a few more putts from 8 feet or 6 feet. That's where you can separate yourself a ton. Scratch golfers don't make 50% of their putts from 8 feet like the pros do. But yeah, from like that 5 to 8 foot window, if you can make more of those, but not all of them, like your odds are still going to be less than 50% for most handicap levels. And then it's a game of proximity outside of 10 feet and just speed control, oversimplification. But if you step on the putting green thinking like make is good, miss is bad, then you're going to just be disappointed all the time because you can't make all your putts. You just can't. It's too hard.
Going back to the long game on that stuff, what is a good shot? What is a bad shot? There's also a good benefit to looking at the controllables. So an example of this is the other day, super windy. I struck the ball out of the sweet spot. I hit the shot. I hit the ground in the right place. And I even started the ball on the line that I wanted to. And as I hit it, the wind picked up, gust of wind blew it left, landed just on the edge of the green, bounced off, rolled into a bunker. And like in terms of stats, that might go down as a bad shot. I controlled to the best of my ability what I could do. So, you know, determining good shots by the factors that we talk about, ground contact, face contact, and overall direction. Because sometimes you could be hitting into a super small green as well. I've seen greens that are like hitting from 180, 200, and they're like 5 yards either side of the pin. And it's just like even the tall pro's not going to knock it onto that every time. They're going to have a 50%. So sometimes you'll miss the green and you've actually hit a good shot. That's where it goes into tracking similar things to tracking what you track in practice. I track these same things on the golf course, you know, that goes beyond strokes gained.
That's a really good point, especially with like, we have a bunch of tiny greens at my golf course on like par threes. And we have like one that's only 120 yards. And people look at it on the scorecard and be like, oh, well, that's a joke of a hole. But once you see it, like the first 40% of the green, if you land it there, it rolls into like the 20 to 30 feet below the hole in these bunkers. So like the actual landing area is very tiny. And I know a good shot most of the time is just like on the back of the green and leaving myself like a 30-foot putt because I don't even want to like mess with the front part of it. So yeah, you have to, as you said, situationally adjust with wind and size of targets and just kind of take yourself out of that mode where you're like, that wasn't good enough. And then you have to like really think about it and you're like, that actually was a good shot. This is just a tough hole in a tough situation. So that's very important as well. Obviously, you can go way more into this, and I did that in the Four Foundations. I showed a lot more stats, and I think that gave people more of a mindset shift where they were more accepting and easier on themselves, and more importantly, made better strategic decisions with that information. So it's a good question, good topic, and you never can learn too much there. All right, we'll wrap that one up. You're next.
We are going to take a quick break, and we will be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Method for getting into the zone. This normally isn't my area, the psychology part, but I've been very interested in zone-like experiences. So the zone, how would you define the zone, John?
I think it's, you know, a state where you're obviously intensely focused and your mind is quieter and like all of the outside distractions, whether those are physical or mental, just kind of fade into the background. So I've had these moments in tournaments, even with like people watching me, where like I don't even see them. Like I am so intensely focused on what's going on in front of me and my breathing and my thought process that it's like everything else is a blur outside of this little circle I'm in. And I love it because I don't see
the gorilla.
I don't see the gorilla. More importantly, it's hard to get, I don't want to get off track too much here, but I love being able to do that with my mind still, just because like the world we live in now has far more distractions in my mind. I find it harder to get there. So I do enjoy being able to get in that place when I compete or play golf. But yeah, a lot of it's just, yeah, you're not seeing the gorilla. That's a great way to sum it up based on what you said earlier.
So you would actually define it differently to how I would. And I see both definitions as true. And I've actually seen some people argue over which one is which. So one would be hyper-focused, like what you're talking about. You're so focused on what you're doing that everything else becomes outside of your bubble. I think that's very worth going into as well. But the other type, the zone that I've entered more often is this one of very little thought. It's almost it's a lack of concentration over the actual shot. But that doesn't mean you're being careless. I'm still going through my pre-shot routine. I'm still selecting the club. I'm still making all my calculations. But when I get over the golf ball, it's like a very flow state. It's like my consciousness disintegrates. And so it's a different type of zone, really.
I would also put that into like my bucket too. Like the way we're describing it, how it feels is the description might be different. But yeah, that applies to like you drive home without thinking of what you did on the steering wheel or your feet. Like the same thing happens in your golf swing. You're just like stepping up and going and you're not thinking about like
the, out, yeah.
Yeah, there's no like, oh, I've got to make sure to do this, this, and this. You're just letting it happen. And that's hard to do in golf because our instinct is like for our mind to take over and steer it.
Yeah, exactly. And so, yeah, with this zoned out experience, I suppose the way that I would make everybody understand what this is like is if you're doing blocked practice on the range, you know, you're hitting ball after ball after ball. Maybe you're even thinking of something else. Maybe you're thinking of what lunch you're going to have later on or what you need to shop for at Tesco's or Walmart. And you don't realize you're actually hitting the ball quite well. And then maybe you come back into focus. You're like, oh, actually, there's been quite a few shots or... So that's a different type of zoned out focus. And the way that you get into this, and it's not always good for everybody, but I'll go through that in a moment. But rhythms help a lot. It's why babies fall asleep when you rock them. It's why we relax when we listen to rhythmical music. Rhythms help with zoning out. It's like even... I suppose I don't want to offend anybody here. Okay, maybe let's think of a tribal dances, right, where there's tribal drums and maybe they're doing a drug experience where they're trying to get into a zoned out state and there's rhythmical drums going on. There's something about humans and rhythms that help us relax. So what can we do to create rhythms? Well, we can keep our routine super consistent. We can make our routine rhythmical as well. In fact, I do routines with people where I get them to count. I don't know if you've ever seen me do this, the counting routine. So they walk in and they're counting with each step. This is one, two, three. And they actually, the rhythm of the beat, I put a metronome in the background. So they have to count to the metronome. And they have the swing on that same tempo as well. So the metronome matches their swings. I've got some of these videos on, I've got it on my blog somewhere. I think it was called The Key to Consistency or something like that, if you want to look at that. So rhythms are huge. Consistency is important as well. What the analogy you used about driving home from work. If you drive the same route every day, same route, that's more likely to get you into that zone state. If you have to change and divert to a different route, you're less likely to get into that zoned out state because you have to be more alert, right? So again, something about humans where when things change, we become more conscious. It's kind of a survival mechanism. Whereas if everything's the same, everything's happening exactly as it normally does, then our consciousness kind of sinks down a little bit. We can operate more on automatic programs. So making sure your routine is rhythmical and consistent. And then the third thing that helps us get into this zone is just a belief that it exists. If you are a control freak, which I have been, and you think that you have to be conscious of everything, you're never going to experience this. If you think that, oh, I can't hit a golf ball unless I'm thinking about my swing, you'll probably never get into this zoned out state. Whereas if you believe that, oh, actually, I can hit golf balls and hit them really well without being conscious or super conscious, then that helps get into that state because you're not frightened when it happens. And both you and I have had very similar experiences where our best golf has come when we've had a song stuck in our head, right? I think I wrote about this in the practice manual. I think you've talked about it as well. Why? Well, it's consistent. We're keeping the same song in our head. It's stuck in our head. It's rhythmical. It's a song. And we're letting go of control, really. We have that belief that it's okay to let my body do what it wants and not be in the driver's seat. So those three things, I think if you have those, are going to help you get in the zone.
Total agreement with everything you said about the music and doing the same thing. We've talked about this before. I don't want to repeat everything you said, but you know, the more I've been thinking about it the last year or so, like my putting routine has been like this, like where I have the music in my head, I'm not thinking about my stroke, I'm rhythmical, and I'm trying to match this more on my approach wedge and tee shots as well, where I'm just totally, as you said, like letting go and just trying to drive home without, you know, on the same route every single time without thinking about what I'm doing. That's when I hit my best shots. It's hard for different skill levels to get there. I think this is probably harder for the more beginner to intermediate player because they probably have to be a little bit more intentional about movements and stuff like that. This is probably like an aspirational thing for higher level players, but I think everyone can make some version of this own little world for themselves over each shot. And you just keep going through it over and over again. At the end of the day, you count up your strokes and you see what happened. Like that's essentially what I'm like asking of myself and other people, like just keep doing that thing over and over again and don't change it too much and find out what works best for you and keep, like, if you need to take a piece out and put another piece in. Even in my conversations with Mackenzie Hughes, like he'll change little things in his routine from week to week, but little adjustments, like I'm talking like very minor ones, and that helps him. So yeah, it depends on the skill level, though, and your experience. So it's something you kind of build towards over time. Like you never kind of get perfect at it, and it can change.
Yeah, that's my one big caveat to all this, is that being in the zone does not automatically make you better. What it does tend to do is make you more consistent. So when I do the counting routine, for example, with people, they lose because their brain is so focused on, right, I got to count 1, 2, 3, 4. I even make them, you know, make a backswing on a certain number and hit the ball on a certain number. I even record them to see how well they're keeping track of the beats with the metronome. So some people are awful at it. The first time they do it, they can't keep count with the metronome. It's way off. It's way out of sync because they're trying to think of their swing. Once they get in sync with the metronome, their thoughts about the swing and their consciousness kind of dissipate because they're so focused on that task. And what I find is they become more consistent, but that doesn't mean better. If they are a shanker, they will shank it more consistently. If they are a slicer, they will slice it more consistently. So just to your point, John, if you have a problem you very likely need to be conscious about implementing a fix for that problem. Whether it's a simple feel or whether it's a more technical cue, there needs to be something there to fix that problem. And so, yeah, for most of my golf, I'm not in the zone. I'm conscious about something. I'm like, right, I've got to make sure I flash the face open to avoid going left today. However, on the days where I'm like, I'm warming up and I'm like, everything's really good today. Everything's firing all cylinders. I'm like, right, today is the day where I've got to try and stay out of my own way. I got to jump into the back seat and put autopilot on, and that's going to be like rhythms. And so it's just understanding when to use this as a tool, really. If you're playing super well and doing that, then don't jump into the conscious driver's seat. And we've had those experiences, right, where you've had a front nine that's, you've torn it up, you've had your best ever front nine and you weren't thinking too hard, and then you tally up your score on the front nine and you go, wow, I've just shot a 39 and I'm having my best one ever, right, I really have to concentrate now. And what happens? You throw yourself out of rhythm, you start changing your routine, maybe making an extra practice swing, and then that you have your worst back nine of your life.
That's why I love the example of the driving thing. It was from Unconscious Putting, which is a great book. Like when you said you tallied up that score on the front nine, you were just driving home, and now on the back nine, you're driving like the police cars in your rearview mirror, and you're like, oh, what do I need to do? Like, got to stay in the speed limit, got to pump the brakes here, got to press the gas pedal. Once you start steering it, quote unquote, and trying to control the outcome and manufacture that score or preserve it into the clubhouse. Like that's, yeah, you know, I tweeted this out the other day, and I always say this in some shape or form, is that the harder you squeeze at this game and the more you try and control it, the more it squeezes right back at you. And it's just like can drive you nuts. And it's cliched and overused, but the more you give up, the more control you actually get. It's just, that's why this game is so awesome and fascinating to me, because it asks humans to do something what they're really bad at, which is giving up control. And there are some places where you can exert that control, like what we're talking about. And then there's some places you can't. And drawing that line and staying on the right side of it is, I don't know, a journey that never ends.
Yeah, you got to know when to be in the driver's seat and when to flip the autopilot switch on.
Yeah, it's hard. Very hard. Great question. As you said, there's no guarantees. I think you do these things to give yourself a better chance at accessing what your potential is and your skill. Your baseline skill isn't high enough. Well, then you're not going to be accessing as much as the player who has more skill, but you're just trying to give yourself a better chance. And I think in this state, you'll have a better chance versus if you were like taking 10 seconds over the ball, then 50 seconds, or thinking about this swing thought, or then thinking about like just you're totally haphazard with your approach, your thoughts, your intentions, and it's just all over the place. That's where I think you're giving yourself less of a chance to hit the good shots, like we said before. What were those good shots?
Have you ever used the focus band before?
No, I haven't. I've heard about it. I actually heard of another. Someone messaged me this morning. They're like, are you using the Bridgestone focus ball? And I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? So apparently Jason Day collaborated with Bridgestone and they made this golf ball that has like three circles on it. And they're like three different intentions during the routine. I can't remember what they are, but it was like a visual guide. And then like the last one is a dot and you're just like focusing on the dot. And the guy's like, I literally have shaved 5 strokes off my score using this golf ball. And I was like, wow, no free ads for Bridgestone. I can't prove or deny if this works or not. But yeah, there's all these different like tools out there. The focus band I have not used. I heard that.
Yeah, this thing's like Quiet Eye and focus band. They had Heart Math for a while. And yeah, I've used the focus band, and what I've found is that, so there's this state you get into called mushing. I haven't read too much about it, and you know, I probably shouldn't even be talking about it with this lack of knowledge, but when I placed the focus band on, I found that I could get into mushing easily, which is supposed to be the desired state, and it felt very much like a zone-like state to me. It was almost like a lack of thought, a freedom. Kind of like if you're just beating balls, ball after ball. However, when I stepped into the ball and hit shots, I moved out of mushing because I started thinking of certain cues that I needed. You know, I had a toe bias pattern, and so I was trying to alleviate that. And so I actually found I hit it worse when I got into mushing because my toe pattern would come in consistently. And when I got out of mushing, when I focused on fixing that, I hit it better, but I was obviously out of the focus band's optimal state then. So it's interesting. I think it has value, but like I said, it'll probably make you more consistent, getting you into that relaxed, free state. But I don't believe it's the optimal state for every golfer, and I don't believe it's the optimal state for every situation. Now, if they want to throw studies at me disproving that, I will happily read those over with a critical eye.
Well, like everything in golf is like, it depends. For some people, like you tell people to hum a song in their head, and for one golfer, that could be like awesome. And for someone else, it's like, this is way too distracting. I can't play like this. This is a silly intention. So yeah, you always, like every question we've addressed in this episode, the common theme emerges that you test and see what resonates the best for your game, because the answers are different.
And there's also certain things that are going to, it depends on what your state you're in, because there are certain times where my brain will have a million things running through it. Like if you put me under pressure, all of a sudden my brain starts whirring. Got all this chatter in my head. I need to bring it down. Where there are other times, most of the time, my brain is relatively quiet and I'll need to bring it up a little bit. So there's different states that you're in. So if I'm in a highly pressured situation, I'll want to try and do something, a single focus that gets rid of that chatter.
Have we tackled that one? Are we ready for the next one?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. What have you got? Okay.
All right, here's one. I'm struggling to stop playing hero shots. How can I stop? Staying disciplined for 18 holes is a struggle. So yeah, I think this is the balance that most golfers struggle with, which is, do you play for optimal score? The point of golf is to shoot your lowest score, but sometimes with the way we want to play and our belief systems are at odds with that. That's why this is a really hard game. So I think the perfect example of this is kind of like recovery situations, what this player is kind of describing is I'm always trying to play hero shots. So one of the hardest things to do in golf is that when you hit that, we'll call bad tee shot, and you've got trees or whatever the case is, you've got a lip of the bunker right in front of you, and your instincts are telling you to go one direction, which is, well, now I got to make up for this mistake. You know, my target score was par or birdie on this hole, and I don't want to give up that target score. Like I still want to do that. And because of that, you want to try something that's a little reckless and dangerous and exciting, a hero shot. And most of the time it doesn't work out. And you just compound your mistake and you shoot a higher score. The question is, how do you stay disciplined for 18 holes? Not everyone can. I don't expect everyone to go out there and make perfect decisions. Some people don't want to play that way. Like sometimes people are really okay with, you know what, I'm a 12 handicap. This is the way I play. I like to go for it sometimes. I love hitting it over the hazard on the par five or threading it the needle on the tree. And if I do it 1 out of 10 times, that's exciting enough for me. And my answer to that is, if you're cool with that and you know that that's probably stopping you from getting down to like a 9 handicap, but it's still enjoyable for you, totally fine. I think it's the golfers who want it both ways that are kind of stuck in that purgatory where they're like, I want my handicap to go down, but like, I still want to do this kind of aggressive hero stuff. Yeah, well, I know what you see on TV. They're always getting out of trouble. And I mean, the things these guys and girls can do with like loft presentation, changing their swing path, the club face, like to get out of trouble, like you cannot do this. You cannot take that 7-iron and sky it over the tree or bend it around there. Like, you just have to accept that. And if you do want to shoot your lowest scores, then the answer is, the answer to the question changes. It's not what can I do to make par here? It's what can I do to get this ball back to safety and give me a clear shot to the green on the next one? And that's a really tough pill to swallow in the moment. And sometimes I have a hard time swallowing it too. I'm not perfect at this. So I think you really need to ask yourself, like, what do you want out of this game? Do you absolutely want to shoot your lowest scores? Then like, yeah, you're going to need to like have that belief system so strongly that in these moments you'll be like, well, I read Mark Brody's book, or I listened to Scott Fawcett, or listened to this show, And I saw that 80% of the time, PGA Tour players make bogey from recovery situations from like 150 yards out. Bogey's a good score here. I'm going to play for bogey. That's hard for people to do sometimes. So I don't know. It's a tough one. Like, I realize not everyone wants to like play the boring, efficient golf at times.
I'm laughing here because I had a shot this weekend that I blocked the drive right and I had to go under one tree, over another, hook it 30 yards into a left-right wind to a green that was about 10 yards wide, and I managed to pull it off. I said afterwards, I've just hit the best shot of my life, and my friends were in the fairway looking at it, and they're like, why are you saying that? It's like 30 feet away. You're normally closer than that. It's like, you didn't see the stuff I had to go over, but it's probably the worst thing for me to pull that shot off, because I tried it again a little later on in a round and didn't quite pull it off, so... Yeah, it's fun when it comes off, but it's definitely not the... I knew this could go either way, these type of shots, and you just have to accept that. Yeah, I was kind of in that headspace that, all right, if I make a double with this, I'm okay with that as well.
Yeah, you just have to be... It's like a mixture of realizing, like, your skill set, how much, like, you could bite off on the shot. The best shot I ever hit in my life, probably... I don't know if people remember the episode where I played in the US Mid-Am. I started off double and bogey, and I was like very nervous. And then like every hole is like 450 with like brutal rough everywhere. And I pull hooked my drive into the trees. And my caddy and I, Will, we were looking at the shot. I was 200 out, like in the middle of the trees. And things weren't going well. My mind's racing. And like we both looked at it and we're like, I'm really good at a low hook shot. Like that's my best shot. And we saw an opening. I'm like, I think I can hit this 5-iron and like bend it around the tree. And it was slightly risky. And I just hit this shot and it goes to 2 feet. Best shot of my life. It worked out. But if I was on the other side, like let's say the situation was reversed and I had to hit a big slice around the tree with the 5-iron, I would have never tried that shot because I can't do that. I don't have that shot. So I would have chipped it out sideways, as painful as that was to do in the moment, and taken my medicine. So there's always this like give and take of like your skill level and the situation. And are you good at adding loft to like clear the trees? Are you good at keeping it low and bending it? You don't always get it right, but like that's the guesswork and I guess the calculation you're trying to make. But yeah, if you keep doing it too aggressively, then like, yeah, you're going to just make a bunch of doubles, triples and quads. And that sucks. So like for every one time you do pull it off, you're going to have way more that you don't. It's kind of like when you talk to gamblers, people who bet on sports, they love to tell you about that 5-team parlay they pulled off, but they don't want to tell you about the 20 or 30 ones that they lost. That's not even close to the amount that they won. Like they lost far more than they won on that one 5-team parlay. But that glory of that one 5-team parlay, like they're going to keep chasing that. And if you want to keep chasing it, that's fine. Just know what you're giving up. That's all I say to people.
Yeah, I'm not a gambler. My friends are. And they always come in, I won this much this week. And in the back of my head, I'm like, yeah. How much did you lose that you're not talking about?
Golf is definitely gambling. That's why it's a fascinating game. Like you are constantly like weighing the odds and the shot and the decision. And I think the recovery situation is like the best example of that, because you're already kind of upset that you're there in the first place. So you've got to deal with that. So you're like on tilt. The answer to the question is, how do you stay disciplined for 18 holes? You have to believe in a deep place that that's the type of golf you want to play. And say like, I want to be the golfer that makes the smart decisions and shoots the lowest scores. And if you believe that in a deep place and hold yourself accountable to that, then you will make the better decision over the long run. And don't expect to be perfect either.
Something that you said that would inspire me to take on more of that mindset is the idea that not everyone can do it. For me, that's enough to say, oh, if lots of people can't do it, I'm going to be the one who does.
Yeah, I want to be the guy.
Stubborn like that, yeah. So yeah, I mean, the fact that this is so difficult to achieve makes it, that should be your fire to actually go out and do it, because it is achievable. It's just you against yourself, right? It's you stopping yourself do this. So just make the decision to do it. It's not like a physical ability necessarily.
Yeah. There's different types of challenges you can set for yourself. And if you set the right challenges, you know, they always say like play stupid games, win stupid prizes. So like in this situation, playing the stupid game is, I don't care what the situation is, I'm going for it. I'm going to try and pull off the miraculous shot, and you'll get stupid prizes, which is a bunch of trees, balls clanking around the trees. But if you change that perspective and say like, no, I'm going to play the even harder game, which is to like outsmart myself and the golf course. You play that game, then you get a better prize, which is a lower score. You just got to choose the right game to play.
Should we save the other questions for another episode?
Sure. Yeah, these are great. Yeah, hopefully people like these when we do these. We get to cover more topics rather than just, not that we won't do our normal episodes where we take one topic and go very in-depth in it, but at least you get some variety here and you won't listen to us drone on about the same thing for 2 hours. Sometimes I wonder, like, you can't, we're fortunate we have a lot of people who listen to us, but we don't get a lot of data back other than like downloads. We can't see how many people are like smiling or cursing at us or anything like that. Yeah. So we're doing our best to give you stuff that we think you're going to like. I think this format's good.
The thing is, for every person that doesn't like us talking for 2 hours about angle of attack, there'll be another person that is just loving it, drooling at the mouth. So yeah, you can always turn it off if you don't like
it. That is the hard part. Like, you know, you'll get some, we get a lot of kind emails, but I'll get an email from time to time being like, someone wrote me the other day, like, man, you just talk about yourself all the time and you can't like get out of your own. I don't know what they said, but something like that. And I was like, okay, yeah, I see that. Like, I do talk about myself a lot, but that's kind of what I do, is like, I talk as a golfer and like, I'm not a swing instructor. That was kind of like my thing when I started this. And hopefully for every one person who emails me that, there's 20 people who love me talking about more anecdotal stuff. But yeah,
we try our best.
Yeah. The unfortunate part about the content game is that you can't please everyone. So I don't know what point I'm trying to make here, but just droning on.
It's the same for me. I mean, I'll do articles where I'll go in depth on something that relates to strike, and you'll inevitably get emails going, oh, this is so complicated. Why don't you simplify things down? You instructors are all the same. And then I'll do a video where I'll simplify it down into just hit the ground here and just play around with that. And then you get everybody going, oh yeah, but you can't do it just any other. It's just, you can't please everybody. And it's just, I get frustrated with myself, like trying to do it. And I just, yeah, I should manage my expectations better with social media.
Yeah,
I think
it's
people
hard.
People going into social media and creating content, I think there's, we need our own coaching on it, on how to like deal with trolls and how to deal with the criticisms and things, because it's not the easiest thing to navigate.
The best way I can do it is say like, yeah, you're going to put something out there, and you can't, once you put it out there, you can't control people's reactions. And of course, I often think about how I react to other people's content. Like sometimes you're just like, oh, I don't like this. You know, person I'm following on Twitter, like I'm sick of this person, I'm gonna unfollow them. Like I've done that, where I'm just like,
is that why you unfollowed me?
Yeah, exactly. I'm like, this message is not resonating with me anymore. And I'm sure there's like thousands of people have done that, being like, I'm sick of this John guy. Like this is annoying. I get that. Like I do that to other people. So I just try and put myself in their shoes. It's just like, there's all these voices coming at you with all these different opinions and ideas. And some of them like are annoying and some of them are helpful. Anyhow, let's wrap up the episode and stop our pity party on how people react to us. Because for the most part,
please be nice to us.
Yeah,
everyone.
we have incredible.
we're fragile here.
Yeah, we're fragile, but we have a lot of people who support us, and that's not to say you can't send me a negative email. Like you absolutely can. I just might not write you back sometimes.
don't send them to me.
All right. On that note, Adam, where can everyone find you?
We are trying our best to help you, give you free content. And if you want to support us, obviously get our programs. Mine are available at adamyounggolf.com. And that free downloadable PDF to track your practice or even track your course stats would be at adamyounggolf.com/track, T-R-A-C-K. John, where can people find you?
Very nice. You can find my new book, The Foundations of Winning Golf, and my other book, The Four Foundations of Golf, on Amazon. You can check out my video course at thefourfoundationsofgolf.com. And seriously, thanks for everyone's feedback and your ideas and your questions. That keeps us going and keeps us providing content for you. And we'll see you next time with a new episode.